Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, limited availability remains in Belfast at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
You sort of meet young women as they came from the country, really, and landed in Dublin city centre. And he'd chat them up, convince them back to his flat, get them eventually to pose for pictures, and then proceed to blackmail them. If they didn't pay him up money, he'd threaten to show these pictures to their parents. It's a very, very sinister crime. You're picking on, really, people's real vulnerabilities, people who don't deserve to be victims of that type of crime.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
The heroin dealer who was dubbed King Scum because he'd flooded Dublin with the drug in the 1980s and 1990s has died aged 81. Notorious Tony Filoni passed away after a heart attack in a hospital more than 13 years after he was last released from a jail term. Today, I'm talking to Niall Donald about the life and crimes of Tony Filoni. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Firstly, I would think that most of our listeners don't know who the hell Tony Filoni is.
Well, I don't know now if that's true. He is certainly long gone in terms of any influence in the criminal underworld, but he was still one of those major points that, like, one of those major figures that helped set up the drugs trade in this country.
Yeah, but I mean, I think he's just, people will not know who he is. I mean, when you think he's 81 years old,
yeah,
years of age, he's died in a pure case of, you know, do whatever you need to do for your health, but genetics really is where it's at, isn't it?
Yeah, well, genetics trumps all. As I mean, for the people who are
guy,
doing,
like, yeah, has, you know,
for the people that are juicing and doing yoga, Tony, yeah, Filoni did the opposite.
Follow Tony Filoni's. No, he got out of prison in 2011, and I remember every headline was, you know, he's only got weeks to live or whatever it was, because, yeah, he was supposed to be in such bad health, he was going to die. That was
2011, I think he was released from,
yeah,
from Portlaoise prison.
So that's 12 years ago. 13 years ago.
Yeah.
So he got another 13 years out of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's died suddenly in a hospital in Dublin. And no doubt he will be mourned.
Yeah, know. But Mel, I think, like, normally we can say when guys die, the criminal figures in the underworld, they will be mourned. And they often are mourned and well-loved by a community and by a family and by people that they've known all their lives. In Tony Filoni's case, I'm actually not sure that's fully true. He was a deeply unpopular figure in Dublin because of his introduction into because of involvement in the heroin trade, which has always been seen as an antisocial thing. But Tony Filoni was also a deeply unpopular person and caused, as much as he caused damage to the city and to the community, he inflicted that damage on his own family. I'm not sure Tony Filoni will be mourned by many, including the people that his own blood relatives. You know,
it's amazing, though, what the passage of time can do. I mean, you look at Larry Dunn and he had a fractured relationship with his own children. But of course, as he got older and as time went by, like a lot of those relationships were healed. And he was a beloved dad when he died. In different circumstances, but not that long ago. And he would have been around the same era as Filoni. And just time, sometimes I think those blood bonds are always there no matter what's happened. And I mean, Tony Filoni was not a good dad. There's no question about it. He was peddling heroin into communities in the inner city and outside them, but he was also peddling it into his own family. And there was a kind of belief that he reckoned that you kept the business in the family and, you know, he was giving drugs to his kids when they were very young.
Yeah, so I mean, he got them involved. Yeah, he got them dealing for him. He got them carrying drugs, delivering drugs, collecting money, all from their early teenage years. Not only did he have them involved in the trade of the business of drug dealing, but he also, it was reported at the time, did almost encourage them to become drugs users themselves. Mm. And the effects of drugs and the heroin business had a terrible effect on his own family. You know, also as a father, I think he was a father of eight.
There's a lot of them, yes.
But he, as a husband, he was a violent wife beater.
So he was married to a sister of Manix Flynn.
He was married to a woman called Anne Flynn, who had also been involved in criminality for a long time, but on a very low level. She was sort of a very, I suppose, infamous shoplifter. You know, these are petty crimes, no doubt about it, but she was one of those people that had been involved in shoplifting on a kind of a professional scale. Mm. But, you know, in the 1960s, they raised a number of children together, but she did an interview many years ago about her life with him. I mean, I think at one stage, just to quote that interview, she said, "He was vicious with drink and often knocked me about, but then he'd be full of remorse." Mm. So the children would have seen Tony Filoni beating his wife up on a regular basis. He was, as well as being a drug dealer, he was a violent criminal and had a particularly predilection to abusing women. In fact, his first sort of foray into the criminal world came with this kind of scheme in the 1960s, where Tony Filoni was a good looking young man. I don't know if you ever saw the pictures of him.
He was the son of Italian immigrants.
Yeah. Italian father and an Irish mother, I think, Irish born mother.
And he had a kind of an Italian sort of a swarthy look about him, but
and he, you know, in the 60s, there's pictures of him dressed in these very fancy suits, very well turned out. And he came up with this kind of scam in the early 1960s, where he sort of meet young women as they came from the country, really, and landed in Dublin city centre. And he'd chat them up, convince them back to go back to his flat, get them eventually to pose for pictures, take these photographs, and then proceed to blackmail them. If they didn't pay him up money, he threatened to show these pictures to their parents. I mean,
put a little bit of social history around that. In the 1960s, there was women coming from rural communities into the city to work in domestic service. I suppose that wouldn't necessarily happen nowadays, but they were kind of fairly innocent.
Yeah.
And they were coming, teenagers probably just even, you know, hadn't even reached their 20s, and they were coming to Dublin, which seemed to be this huge, big city, unfriendly city, and they would have to try and find their accommodation, a job, and then they'd settle down and they'd write letters home. I mean, it's so many miles away from what happens today. It was a quaintness to the life of it, but it left them kind of in their innocence a little bit vulnerable to the likes of Filoni and no doubt others who preyed on them. But he would sort of, you know, seduced them with his good looks and with his charm. They thought that they were
you know, meeting this...
They'd met a nice guy and maybe they'd one day bring him home. And instead, he was taking their wages off them and blackmailing.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, really, if you think about it, because all of this stuff has been in the papers again in the last couple of weeks about people, you know, using the internet to use revenge porn to blackmail women. I mean, it's amazing that Tony Filoni was doing something similar back in the 1960s. Mm. You know, and it's again, we know it now and we believe it then as well, obviously. It's a very, very sinister crime and you're picking on really people's real vulnerabilities, people who don't deserve to be victims of that type of crime. As he went along, he also became involved in the prostitution trade, which again was a very, very different thing. Some of these women that he met, he seems to have forced them into prostitution in one sense. And it was always said that, you know, that business in particular in that time was backed up by a lot of violence. He was effectively a pimp, and probably his first major conviction was for procuring young women for immoral purposes, a charge that is...
When was that?
That was in 1964. So that's that's obviously to do with prostitution. It's a charge that's long gone and has changed through the statute books over the years. But it's effectively, you know, pimping people out. So all of that was backed with this kind of sinister, violent temperament. As the criminal underworld kept changing, Tony Filoni became heavily involved in burglaries, to a degree involved in armed raids. And that's of its time as well throughout the 70s. He had a number of convictions through that time, relatively minor at that stage. He served a period of time in prison and then left for the UK. Disappeared off the radar for a while around 1980, but when he got over to England, that was his first introduction to the heroin trade, which didn't really exist in Dublin at that stage.
I was going to say, so he was arrested in Surrey in 1981 and he was jailed for 4 years for conspiracy to import heroin. Like that, they are the earliest... journeymen into the heroin trade, because it's really only in the late 70s, I think, very late 70s, that heroin sort of becomes available in Europe.
And at that stage, heroin and the heroin users, the typical sort of background of the heroin users in the late 70s is really college student and bohemian types. I mean, this it wasn't a sort of an inner city drug, but it did rapidly become so during the 80s. And people like Tony Filoni were at the forefront of turning it in from really a bohemian pastime that no doubt caused great destruction even then, but to turn it into what became an epidemic, not just in Ireland, but also across England and Scotland and cities like Liverpool in particular.
And I think it was just, it wasn't at all to do with what was happening in Iran. That
it was, and you know, that made
a lot of wealthy people had to flee. They couldn't take their money with them, so instead they took heroin and, you know, turned it into cash when they got to Europe. And
I mean,
that because of the flood of the heroin, it became, that's when it started going into the sort of the poorer communities rather than that sort of old, it probably would have even been called opium before that, would it?
Well, opium is different than heroin, even though they're both comes from the same thing. Yeah, but it would have been
it was obviously way back, there was opium deaths.
Yeah, and I mean, even in the 19...
houses and...
Yeah, and even in the 19... there was always a heroin trade to a degree in Europe. And even if you go back to the 1930s with Lucky Luciano and these guys in America in the mafia, there was a heroin trade and they were done for heroin. But it was the explosion of it into the inner city that came with this mass availability of heroin into Europe. And if you remember back then, like the police forces really weren't prepared for it. They just didn't consider it to be a priority. I mean, I think we're looking back at those days in the 80s, wasn't there, I can't remember the exact statistic, there was two people on the drugs unit in the Gardaí or something. It was just really wasn't something that they were prepared for. In Ireland, all of the Garda resources were going into policing the troubles in the north and the spillover down
here. That story is well told in Dublin Narcos by Michael O'Sullivan, who went on to become the chief in the Mauoc, in the Marine. Lisbon-based sort of European
maritime
police force. But he was in that first drug squad, essentially, along with Noreen O'Sullivan, the ex-commissioner. Yeah. And he went in sort of undercover into some of the ecstasy parties, etc., to try and buy drugs. But Filoni was one of the first guys that they...
targeted.
Yeah. And there was something about... He told an interesting story about finding money or drugs in a brick in the wall that he used to kind of go into his house and hide the stuff outside so he couldn't be caught with it. But they did target him. And he wasn't very long operating. Like, he was only back in the Republic in 1984 and he was jailed. He got a 10-year sentence in 1986. So within 2 years, he had sort of flooded the place with heroin, flooded his own family with the drug as well, and, you know, found himself before the courts.
Yeah, he was before the courts very quickly, but he was back in Dublin at the height of that first wave of heroin, the heroin business. And even then he was making big money. Mm. You know, you can look back at it now and it feels almost like a very amateurish operations to a degree. There wasn't the sophistication that we see now, where people are not willing to handle stuff, not willing to have stuff around them. Major drug dealers may never even be in the room with a drug shipment or even an amount of money. But it wasn't like that then. But Tony Filoni was still an organized dealer. He had a lot of his children working for him, but he also had other associates as well. And they were really focused on providing heroin within flat complexes around the inner city. I mean, that's where the business was. He was caught quickly. He was given a 10-year sentence, but he was out, I think, within 6 or 7 years. And when he came out again, at that point, the Dunn operation, which had been the primary heroin operation at the time, was gone. Tony Filoni certainly had those contacts in the UK in order to get the heroin in, which is, at that point, nearly all the heroin was coming from UK sources. A lot of it was coming over on the ferries in kind of mule smuggling, as it might be called now. It wasn't being brought in on containers, or we've had heroin being brought in on planes into Ireland. Most of it was sending addicts across the way to meet somebody, buy it and bring it back in relatively small amounts. So Tony Filoni, as soon as he came out of prison, he was straight back into the drugs trade. And at that point, he probably became certainly one of the major suppliers within the inner city. And at that point as well, of course, what had happened to him personally, while he'd started off in the heroin business without being an addict, he'd progressed, or you know, maybe progressed is the wrong word, but he'd become a very chronic heroin addict at that point himself. Mm. And he seems to have been way more chaotic the second time in the early 90s.
There was actually a second wave of heroin as well in the early 90s, because it's at that point in around, it's 96 when he's jailed again for a second time, this time for 20 years. I think I was in court that day, but I think he was caught with a huge amount of it. But anyway, I don't have the detail to hand, but there was a second wave in the 90s, because it was around that time, sort of mid, say 92 to around 96, where you had Tony Gregory standing up in the Dáil, and he was naming George Mitchell, Thomas Mullen, the boxer, Derek Maradona Dunn, and obviously the Dunn family, sort of certainly Larry Dunn, etc., were well known as heroin dealers. So they were all sort of being, you know, accused of this second wave that came in. And that first wave in the 80s killed people off, because they were injecting it. In the 90s, the second wave that came in, the generation who had watched sort of parents and older people die from injecting it, and the HIV and AIDS followed, along with hepatitis. They believed that they could take heroin, but they'd be okay if they smoked it.
Yeah.
And that was what that second wave was involved in. So that sort of was the second big wave of money, really, for Filoni. So he was jailed in 96, as was his son Luigi, who was jailed in 96 in June for heroin dealing. And his daughter, Regina Filoni, was also jailed for 6 years and 9 months for heroin dealing. And she would have been in to Mountjoy Women's Prison, which had just opened as the Doka Centre. And I do recall she sort of got healthy in prison.
Yeah.
She came off the drugs and she sort of got better, really. As
yeah.
That was a really significant thing when the DOCA centre was opened, because it was very, treated women very well. Their children were allowed to come in to see them in an environment that didn't feel like prison. I think she might have been pregnant in prison, Regina Filoni.
Yeah.
And the women were allowed to keep their babies for the first 12 months with them.
Yeah.
They had their own room. And if there was rehabilitation going to happen, it happened within that environment, whereas it hadn't before. While the Filonis were in jail, the Criminal Assets Bureau came in and trawled around their bank accounts and assets, and they found good bit for that time, about €300,000.
Yeah, I think it was €400,000 in total, including properties. So, I mean, you're looking back at those days and you can see the money is just literally being spent on people buying houses and lodging big sums in their own bank accounts. It was just a totally different world than what we see now. So he became the first target of the Criminal Assets Bureau, and he resisted it tooth and nail while he was in prison. I think it was 14 years before it was finally and utterly completed. It didn't just look at his own personal assets, but some assets of some members of his family. And but he, in that time, he was put in Port Leash in amongst the highest security prisoners of the time, including people like John Gilligan. You would have had Marlow Highland in that sort of section of Port Leash prison. Desi O'Hare, you know, really, really serious criminals. But by the time Tony Filoni was jailed, by all accounts, his time in prison wasn't particularly comfortable. He was shown very little respect. He was significantly down the food chain. He had bad health. He'd contracted HIV himself as a result of his drug use, and really was pushed around in prison by all accounts. Kind of attached himself to John Gilligan, who seemed to sort of, bully him around a bit, if you want to call it that. And he was a deeply unpopular person, I think, in the public eye. You're right, he probably is forgotten about, but if you remember back in 1996 when he was convicted, he really was.
Huge. I mean, it was a huge story at the time, and 20 years was massive. And
one of the reasons it was massive was because he kept getting caught in the run up to that. When he run up to his conviction, what happened was, I think he got caught 3 times, and he was given bail on each occasion. And he obviously felt like you might as well be, you know, done for a penny as a pound, or a pound as a penny, or whatever it is, in that, like, he knew he was going to prison anyway. He had those previous convictions for heroin. He wasn't going to get off scot-free. So even when he was out on bail, he just kept going and he kept getting caught. And it caused a huge scandal at the time. It moved from like a criminal justice story to being a political scandal, because he was allowed out on bail despite obviously breaking his bail conditions, which are that you don't become involved in crime. And that led to legislative changes to the bail laws to allow people to object to bail, and, you know, a few other technical things, because it became a kind of a sense of this revolving door where it didn't really matter. Once you're going to be done for something, you might as well just keep clocking up the convictions, which we still see to this day with lesser offences. People, you know, public order or whatever, people just, you know, rack them up, I'm going to be done, and it's all going to run concurrently. But he got 20 years, which is a huge sentence, really, if you consider it. And there was,
I think it was the lengthiest sentence at the time. You know, you had a few people that got really long sentences, Damon Kelly.
Yeah, and John Gilligan as well got a very, very lengthy sentence.
Yeah.
Dutchie Holland.
A couple of those big, you know, 20, 30 year sentences. And on appeal, some of them were lessened. He appealed, and his the final appeal of his sentence, now I don't know whether that was for the conviction or for the length of the sentence, but it was dismissed in 99. But at that point, it was all in those probation reports that it came out about the probation and the psychiatric reports that were required for those appeals, that it came out that he was HIV positive. It said that he was totally institutionalized in prison, and that he had obtained drugs. He had a very heavy drug addiction, but he had obtained the drugs in prison, which obviously he had to pay for by whatever means. And at one point it was said that he was unable to manage on his own for more than 2 days, like he almost was in need of a carer.
Yeah.
And thus, when he re-emerges from prison in 2011, there was this furore around him that he wasn't going to survive and that he was so ill, you know, he was a dependent drug user and, you know, how was he going to even survive the first day? And of course, such a high profile prisoner. There was a selection of journalists and photographers waiting outside. I think he was in Mountjoy and he came out that back door of Mountjoy that day. I was there the day he was released and he hopped in a taxi, made his way into town and everybody kind of driving after him to what end, maybe just to try and, you know, see what he had to say. But he was wily enough to make his way into town, hopped out of the taxi at the Halfpenny Bridge and he ran over the Halfpenny Bridge, which was the pedestrian bridge, obviously. Yeah. So unless you could abandon your car, that was him gone. So it was quite a clever move and he just disappeared into Temple Bar and it was like, here he was back in his city, what was he going to do? And he was living kind of in social housing, I think, somewhere in the north or south inner city then.
Yeah.
And he just... little was heard of him since.
Little was heard of him. Every now and again, he was photographed. He did, from time to time, appear in the courts. He retained a close relationship to a number of his children, certainly after his release. Not all of them. I mean, some of his kids, not to get into them specifically, but certainly did get clean and went on to live good lives. So he was pictured here and there. He actually used to be pictured sometimes just appearing in court,
right?
Supporting people or, you know, things like that rather than for himself. He certainly never became involved in criminality. His days were long, long gone by the time he got out. And he presumably lived a very humble life before dying of a heart attack of natural causes. It's a sorry tale, I think, if you look back on it from start to finish, from the 1950s to the mid 2020s, a lot of misery spread, a lot of damage done. You know,
and not lived to his 80s.
He still lived to his 80s.
It is just incredible that element of it, though, isn't it? Like, you know what I mean?
It is, you know, yeah, you can do your yoga and juicing as much as
all you want. And he's been on the launch pad since he was like, I mean, honest to God, I have never seen more headlines that he was on the launch pad to heaven or hell, wherever he's going. But he manages to make it to 81, which is a ripe old age.
King Scum, of course, was his name.
Yeah, and there was a great book written by Paul Reynolds called that. I must stick it out, have it somewhere at home.
I read it myself. It was really good. It was a really good history, obviously of Tony Filoni, but it's actually really interesting, the bits in, and I can't remember all the details now. You read just how amateurish the drug dealing was at that stage in terms of, like, as you said, their big concession to getting out of it would be, you know, hide it just outside the door. I think there was some in a letterbox, and that was the security measures they take. But despite all that, there was huge money to be made, and their business was really solely in those different inner city flat complexes, and they changed the character of Dublin inner city. Tony Filoni and people like that, I mean, they effectively participated in a generation being wiped out. And in some ways, people will still say that the inner city communities never recovered from the heroin epidemic. Filoni and his people like him, you know, made their money, but they made it on the back of a generation being wiped out, and you had kids being raised by grandparents. Look, terrible. It's not, no one man is responsible for what happened, but Tony Filoni really didn't seem to care.
He certainly made his mark. Okay, Niall, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from sundayworld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free sundayworld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.